Well, maybe we should sit down and
to the best of my knowledge, the only folks, Oscar Coagley should be in very shortly. Mm-hmm. He's getting in just about now to the airport, so he should be very soon. Raina Green and Bernard Nietzschmann will probably miss the whole of today.
Mm-hmm. And Dennis Dimmert, too.
I haven't heard anything from Dennis lately, except that he was going to have to be in and out and was uncertain of just exactly when he would get here and how long he could stay. He has gotten together with David since, and David may know a little bit more. But he thought it unlikely that he'd make it in today, but it was a possibility. So I just wanted you to be aware that some of these folks...
So that's Dimmert, Raina, Nietzschmann, and Oscar. Everybody else is...
There's plenty of room here. We've got just two people at a table and must be cases.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could take our seats and since this is being videotaped, maybe you could just turn your name card around so it is facing away from you. It is the idea is that you know who you are, so you should feel free to turn your card around. And speaking of knowing who you are and who we all are, my name is Tom Berger, and I'll ask all of you at the round table to introduce yourselves in a few minutes, but I'm going to take the liberty of saying a few words in opening the proceedings. I think that I should tell you that of those who were expected to attend, I think only one will be unable to attend. That is Hans Pavia Rosing, the president of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference. He is unable to leave Greenland to come to this gathering. But Oscar Coagley of Bethel, Alaska, who is one of the executive board members of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, will be joining us, and he should be here sometime this morning. Clem Charche, the president of the World Council of Indigenous People, will be here later on today. Raina Green of the Native American program at the Smithsonian will be here later today, and Bernard Nietzschman of the University of California, who has been engaged in the negotiations between the Sandinistas and the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua, will be here later today. Dennis Demert of the University of Alaska Fairbanks may not be able to join us until tomorrow. I should say that we have a number of folks have come to observe, and I'm glad that they are here. I understand that Steve Cacqui, the president of the Dene Nation in Canada, is coming to observe, and Josephine Bigler of Church House in New York is here with us to observe, and I'm glad to welcome Ms. Bigler. The way in which we thought we would proceed is this. I'll start off by introducing the subject, and then we will ask Professor Hanke to speak to the paper that he prepared, and after that we will simply have an open discussion for the rest of the day. Then tomorrow morning we will ask Bishop Remy DeRue to discuss the paper that he has prepared and that is available now on the condition of Native peoples as seen by a proponent of the theology of liberation, and that will, I think, give a focus to the discussion to tomorrow morning. And I hope that we can have give and take as we move along with the discussion. The roundtables that we've had so far have been much bigger, sometimes 25, 30 participants, so the discussion had to be rather more structured. This roundtable, we thought, should be a good deal smaller, and it was felt that that would enable us to have more give and take at the roundtable. So I hope you'll bear that in mind. Having said that, let me welcome you again and tell you that this is the last public session of the Alaska Native Review Commission, and the commission has been, in a sense, a unique undertaking. Established by the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, an international organization of Eskimos from Alaska, Canada, and Greenland, and co-sponsored by the World Council of Indigenous People, an international organization of Native peoples around the world. The Commission has held 60 hearings in villages and towns throughout Alaska, in every region of Alaska. Those hearings began at Amonik, an Eskimo village on the Bering Sea, in February 1984, and they took us throughout the state of Alaska, as I say, to 60 villages and towns. More than 1,450 Alaska Natives and other Alaskans, non-Native Alaskans, predominantly Alaska Natives, but there were quite a lot of non-Native Alaskans as well. More than 450 testified at those hearings around the state. We had a 61st hearing last weekend at another village that has a large population of Alaska Natives, that is Seattle. And to my surprise, there was quite a large turnout of Alaska Natives in Seattle, and they kept us there 2 days, and they would have kept us there two more days if we had had the time to stay and to hear their evidence. And there were some divergences between what Alaska Natives here in Alaska had told us and what Alaska Natives in Seattle told us, But the divergence was not as great as many of us had thought it might be. Well, in addition to all of those hearings, which are now concluded, we have had a series of public roundtable discussions. And those roundtable discussions have been held here at the Fur Rendezvous Palace. They were roundtable discussions which began with the history of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the expectations of some of those who were Native leaders back in the late 60s and early 70s, the expectations of those in Congress who were responsible for its enactment, the shortcomings as perceived by both sides in the light of 14 years of history. And then in the fall, we had a roundtable on subsistence, a subject of very great importance here in Alaska, the whole question of access to wildlife resources and native participation in the fishery. And then we had a roundtable on 1991, all the questions of that the corporate structure raises for the protection and preservation of native ownership of native ancestral land in Alaska. Then we had another roundtable on native government in December, and we dealt with questions of self-determination and self-rule and native sovereignty. And now, with all of that behind us, we thought it would be useful to convene this hearing today. Now, would you forgive me if I just spent a few minutes talking about the land claim settlement here so that it will be present in our minds, at least as a background for our discussion. Under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, Alaska Natives were to receive $962.5 million over a period of years and 44 million acres of land. This is necessarily simplified, but the money and the land were turned over to Native corporations. Congress said to Alaska Natives, to get this money and to get this land, you have to set up corporations. And 12 regional corporations were established in each of the 12 regions of Alaska. They are large corporate organizations, and they received certain lands, and they received money. And 200 Native village corporations were established as well. And these were established in all the small Eskimo, Indian, and Aleut villages of Alaska. And those village corporations were established so that those people living in the villages where the majority of Alaska Natives then lived and still live, so that they could receive their share of the money and the land. So that the proceeds of the settlement became corporate assets. And indeed, Alaska Natives were told that unless you set up these corporations, you are not eligible to receive the money and the land. So the proceeds of the settlement became corporate assets. The idea at the time, and I think this was a notion widely held by Congress and among Native leaders and Native people in Alaska, was that the Land Claim Settlement Act, ANCSA as it is called, that's the acronym that we all use, that ANCSA would usher in an era of progress and development. Now, the most important economic activity in those villages then was subsistence hunting and fishing, and I think it was implied that subsistence hunting and fishing would be a thing of the past, that that way of life would give way in an orderly and natural progression to a way of life approximating that of people in the lower 48 and the majority of non-native Alaskans. And indeed, since 1971, it is clear from the testimony we've received in the villages that Native people in Alaska feel that there have been encroachments. Since 1971, they associate these with ANCSA. Whether or not they were brought about by ANCSA is another question, but they're associated with the post-ANCSA era. And they feel there have been encroachments on their right to freely to engage in hunting and fishing for subsistence, and there is great resentment and bitterness about those encroachments. There is also great resentment about the land claim settlement itself, unhappiness and bitterness and even anger in many places for reasons that I'll come to in a moment. Now, the Alaska Native population is the largest per capita Native population in the United States of America, and because of the climate and geography of Alaska, the fact that the land here is not sought for agricultural purposes, it isn't like the movement westward across the plains, it hasn't been thus far necessary to displace the Native people from their ancestral lands. It has been necessary, or at least whether necessary or not, it has occurred. It has been decided to share out the state of Alaska, and the federal government has acquired certain lands, the state has acquired certain lands, and Native people have acquired certain lands. Their 44 million acres constitutes approximately 10% of the land area of the state. That 44 million acres is, as I say, held by Native corporations. Well, these corporations have not, on the whole, fared well. The regional corporations, some of them have made money, some of them have lost money. Some of them are somewhere in between. The 200 village corporations have, on the whole, lost money. Many of them are in very bad shape, many of them perilously close to bankruptcy. Only a few have succeeded in the way that Congress seemed to think was likely. Of course, in the Arctic and subarctic regions of North America, this is true of Canada and Greenland as well as of Alaska, economic prospects in those remote areas on the Arctic Ocean and the Bering Sea, on the Yukon and the Kuskokwim Rivers, economic opportunities are limited. And it was, in a sense, unrealistic to expect that these corporations could establish viable business undertakings that would employ any significant number of people and provide dividends to their shareholders. And so you have a record through many regions of the state of failure on the part of village corporations and a feeling on the part of the people out there that the deck was stacked against them. In fact, there are three principal dangers to continued Native ownership of ancestral lands in Alaska. The first is corporate failure, corporate bankruptcy. And since the land is a corporate asset, if a corporation fails, if it goes bankrupt, its land can be attached. It can be seized by its creditors. Native land could be lost in that way. After 1991, as I suppose everybody knows, the shares in the Native corporations will go on the market, unless the law has changed in the meantime, and they can be bought and sold like shares in any other corporation. All our experience leads us to believe that there will be attempts to take over Native corporations. And of course, if a Native corporation is taken over by a buyout of its shares, then it will no longer be a Native corporation, and its assets, principal asset being Native land, will no longer be Native land. There is a third thing that has to be borne in mind, and that is the financial condition of the state of Alaska. The main source of revenue for the state of Alaska is the oil field at Prudhoe Bay. Oil provides 90% of the state's revenues. The Prudhoe Bay field provides 85% of that 90%. We are told that production at Prudhoe Bay is declining. We are told as well that there may be reductions in the price of oil internationally. And that means that the state's revenues dependent to a great extent on one oil field whose production is declining, that state revenues in the 1990s may decline. That means that the state in the 1990s may begin to look for other sources of revenue. And in the 1990s, 20 years after native lands are conveyed to the native corporations, native land, even if it is undeveloped, even if it is used only for subsistence, becomes liable to taxation. So that is a third danger, it seems to me, that cannot be overlooked. That is that in the 1990s, this land will gradually become subject to state taxation, and that if the state decides that 44 million acres of privately held land, because the native land is held by private corporations, native corporations established under state law, then even a very minimal tax, let us say 25 cents an acre per annum, would mean that native corporations would have to raise $11 million a year. Many of the native village corporations, even some of the regional corporations, would have great difficulty in raising their share of such a tax. So that through corporate failure, corporate takeover, or state taxation, this land is very likely in the years ahead to be at risk and to flow from native ownership into non-native ownership. Well, in the villages and in the round tables and throughout Alaska, there are discussions about what is to be done. There are two lines of action that are being considered. One is people say, well, look, to make sure that our native corporations remain in native ownership, let us ask Congress to pass a law that says that native people can't sell their shares after 1991. And that's discussed. Should there be restrictions on the right of native people to sell their shares? Isn't that the only way to keep native land in native ownership, native corporations under native control? Other people say, well, look, this is the United States of America. Freedom of choice is sanctified by all of our traditions, and native people with shares should be allowed to sell them after 1991. And in the villages, I found that native people overwhelmingly said, no, we shouldn't have the right to sell our shares. This land should stay in native ownership in perpetuity. We should pass it on to our children. A very small minority of native people in Alaska said, no, we're entitled to sell our shares. I've got nothing out of this settlement. I've got no money, no dividends, no job, no land out of this settlement. All I've got are these shares. Let me sell them in 1991, or I'll never get anything out of this. And if that means the land drifts into non-native ownership, so be it. Well, that's a minority view here in Alaska, but among Alaska natives in Seattle, it was a view widely held, and we heard that last weekend. Many of the Alaska natives living out of state said, look, I've got nothing out of this settlement. I've got these shares. Let me sell these suckers in 1992. That was the expression some of them used. Then I'll walk away from the settlement with something. And they said, that's freedom of choice, personal choice. Let me sell these shares. Well, of course, that's freedom of choice. It's a matter of personal choice in a way, but it's a choice that if you're a native person, you make not only for yourself, but for your children and your grandchildren and all of your descendants. If you give up your interest in native ancestral lands, because the only interest you have is the share you hold in a native corporation, then you're making a choice for all of those who come after you. Well, it presents a dilemma and a whole series of cultural and traditional and modern values are at war in the resolution of that dilemma. Well, the other course of action that many native people in the villages have urged is this. They say, look, we still have tribal governments. We have IRA governments under federal law. We have traditional governments that we've always had long before there was the United States of America or the state of Alaska. They are still functioning. Let's transfer the land from the corporations to our tribal governments because they can't go bankrupt, they can't be taken over, and they are, it is thought, immune from taxation. So there is another course of action being urged that entails the strengthening of tribal governments in the bush to be the vehicles for holding native land in perpetuity, and also, I may say, for seeking on behalf of native people in the bush to regain the ground lost in the area of subsistence, to see if additional subsistence rights that have been lost cannot be regained. Well, forgive me for that little lecture on what we've been doing here and the issues involved here. I suggested when I spoke to the Tanana Chiefs Conference yesterday that it may not be a question of either or, it may not be a question of either corporations or tribal government. There may be places, maybe place for both. Maybe Native people here in Alaska can use both types of institutions to their advantage. It may be that the matter can be resolved in that way. Well, we're not asking you to resolve those questions here today. They are difficult questions. We've been struggling with them for over a year. And in my report, which will be made public in September, I will make my recommendations on those very difficult and knotty issues. But those of us working on the commission and working on the report that we're doing thought that to come up for air, so to speak, we would convene this meeting and ask all of you to think about the place of Native people in the Western world, and we thought that we might arm ourselves with the reflections that that you will offer through these next 4 days, and that a consideration of the moral and ethical and philosophical questions that underlie the continuing struggle of Native peoples, Indigenous peoples around the world to affirm their place in and their way of life would be useful. And let me say this, that I hope the discussion over the next 4 days will be as much an examination of the way that Native people look upon their place in the Western world. Will be as much directed to an examination of the values of the dominant society, the European institutions established here in North America, the European values to which I think we all in one way or another subscribed, and which have become dominant. I think that we should be looking at the dominant society as well as Native societies, and I think that in that way we will have a better idea of the place of Native peoples in the Western world. And I can tell you that in the bush, in those villages, people have been raising these questions. They have asked, at village after village, they have said, by what right did the white people come here, take our land, and make laws and say that we must obey them? And they have said it is as if we were to go to New York City and to start passing laws and say, all right, everybody here has to obey those laws. And they say, by what right do you come here and tell us that you're going to make laws that will bind us? Others have said, by what right did Russia sell our land to the United States? Back in 1867, Russia sold Alaska, or at least they sold the right to trade with the Native peoples here, sold it to the United States, one great power selling jurisdiction, purported jurisdiction over this great land to another great power. And Native people in the bush have said to me, by what right did Russia sell our land to the United States? And one Native person, an older man, said, how could these great powers hand our land over the counter like a toy? They acknowledge that the clock cannot be turned back, but insist that they are entitled to be treated fairly now and in the future. And I think those questions have never been answered. Now, under international law, effective occupation determines jurisdiction and personality under international law, but from a moral and ethical and philosophical point of view, have we ever come to grips with these issues? We're not, of course, concerned simply with the native peoples of Alaska. We've had testimony from Alaska natives, Eskimos, Aleuts, and Indians. We've had roundtable participants representing many Indian tribes from the lower 48. We have had many witnesses from Canada, from Greenland, Australia, and Moses Kial is here today representing Hawaii, and others have come from Hawaii to observe. And I should say that just yesterday I received from Norway the first report of the Norwegian Sami Rights Committee, the Smith Committee, which has spent 4 years studying the rights of the indigenous people of Norway. I say that I received the report. I received the version, the Norwegian version, 6 months ago, but I've now received a summary in English, for which I am most grateful. Now, we meet at a time when native people all over the world are seeking to establish their right to self-determination and to land. Pope John Paul II, in September 1984, affirmed that native people are entitled to take their rightful place among the peoples of the earth. The Pope also affirmed the right of native peoples to self-determination. He was speaking to the native peoples of Canada, but he was addressing native peoples throughout the world, and he said, you are entitled to self-determination. He said, for you, a land base with adequate resources is also necessary for developing a viable economy for present and future generations. He said, you need likewise to be in a position to develop your lands and your economic potential. Now, the question of native rights is centuries old, older than the ideological struggles of our time. The expansion of the European powers, first Spain and Portugal, then France and England, into the New World raised the question, what right did they have to take the land and subjugate the peoples of the New World? What right did the Russians have to take the land of the indigenous peoples of Siberia and then, after crossing the Bering Strait, lay claim to the land of the Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts here in what is now the state of Alaska? Whether expanding westward across the Atlantic or eastward across Siberia, the Europeans, and I regard the Russians as Europeans, and I hope we can put that to rest. I think they clearly are Europeans and not Asians. Whether expanding westward or eastward, the Europeans did so in the name of Christ, of civilization, of trade, and on behalf of an idea that peoples advanced in manufactures and weaponry and literacy had the right to dispossess people of different cultures. Now, these Europeans are now locked in ideological combat, but neither of their secular prophets offers any satisfactory answer to the claims of native people. Adam Smith and Karl Marx are both products of the Industrial Revolution, a comparatively recent event in the long sweep of history. It was the great American Chief Justice John Marshall who developed in the 19th century the ideas on which native claims to self-determination, native sovereignty, that's the expression that Marshall used. He referred to the limited sovereignty of native peoples. He developed the ideas on which native claims to self-determination and Aboriginal title have been advanced ever since. John Marshall based his propositions on international law. With the overrunning of native peoples, international law receded in the consideration of their rights. But today, with the conventional models of colonialism a thing of the past, consideration is being given to the claims of the indigenous peoples, the peoples of what George Manuel calls the Fourth World, peoples locked within nation states and, with few exceptions, without the possibility of politically independent status under international law. The International Labor Organization dealt with this subject in the 1950s. The United Nations, in its resolutions, began to grapple with the issue in the 1960s. In 1975, in the Western Sahara case, the International Court of Justice rejected the idea that in the case of indigenous peoples, the doctrine of terra nullius affords a basis for external powers to take their land. And maybe at some stage during the next 4 days, we will think about the question, suppose today the Europeans discovered a new world inhabited by different cultures, people who would could not effectively resist the Europeans, who could be subdued and subjugated, would we have the right to take their land? Is there any doctrine of international law that would justify taking their land? And if there is no doctrine of international law that today would justify taking their land, how could we justify taking their land in the 15th and 16th centuries? Well, I'm looking at Doug Sanders when I say that, because he raised this question a year ago, and no doubt later on he'll return to it. Well, what then is the place of native peoples in the Western world? It is my view that they have a special place, unlike that of any minority, with claims to land and self-government that no other minority can assert. And to work out a fair accommodation with the native peoples is a challenge to the Western democracies, one I hope that we will address at this round table. And may I say again that our strategy, if it can be dignified as such, is to have an unstructured discussion, conversation. I'm going to call on Professor Hanke to follow me in the discussion, and then simply to leave it open to any of you to follow Professor Hanke. And if at noon it seems to you that we should revise our strategy, that some structure should be incorporated in the discussion, please feel free to mention it to David Case, who sits to my right, who is, many of you are not aware, author of the leading textbook on the rights of Native people in Alaska, and Rosita Worrell on my left, who is a special consultant to the commission and a well-known anthropologist as well as publisher of Alaska Native News, to which you are all invited to subscribe, and don't share your copy. We want to make sure that everybody subscribes. But if you feel at noon, or and you'd like at noon to speak to Rosita or David or me about the way we're proceeding, please do so informally, and Rosita and David and I confer throughout, and we will try to keep things on the road. Now, might I just ask each of you to introduce yourselves, starting with David Case on my right, and I see Daley Sambo has arrived, and that's, I thought Daley was at the round table, but she's busy with many things that may keep her away from the round table. But Daley Sambo is the special assistant to the president of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and has contributed greatly to the success of the work of the commission. I say success perhaps provisionally, but let's assume that thus far it has been a success. So, David, would you introduce yourself, and we'll carry on that way.
My name is David Case. I'm counsel to the commission.
Bishop Remy Zero, Victoria, B.C. I'd like to make a minor correction. I am a Catholic bishop from Western Canada, not the Catholic bishop for Western Canada. And please correct Vancouver to Victoria.
I'm Robert Goldwyn, Director of Constitutional Studies of the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C.
I'm Moses Ke'ale, Trustee for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs from Hawaii.
I'm Oren Young from the Center for Northern Studies, located in Vermont.
I'm Shelton Davis from the Anthropology Resource Center in Washington, D.C.
I'm Doug Sanders, a professor of law at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver and a counsel for the World Council of Indigenous Peoples.
I'm Hugh Brody of No Fixed Institutional Address from London, England.
I'm Verna Kirkness, Director of Native Education, the University of British Columbia.
Henry Hsu, I'm a philosopher at the Center for Philosophy and Public Policy at the University of Maryland.
Louis Hanke, a retired historian from the University of Massachusetts.
Rosita Worrell, Special Consultant to the Commission.
Well, may I call down Professor Hanke, and may I be allowed to say in introducing him that all of us are great admirers of Professor Hanke, who is, I think, the leading American scholar on the Spanish conquest and on the great debate between Bartolomé de las Casas and Sepúlveda in 1550, and whose book, Aristotle and the American Indians, many of us have read with profit, and whose many other books we have, some of us read, with equal profit. And I'm very glad that Professor Hanke was able to join us. He has prepared a paper that you've all read, and I'd ask Professor Hanke now to offer some remarks.
Mr. Chairman, I suppose the first question is, what is a historian like myself doing here? How can a person concerned with the 16th century have any relevance for those of you who are struggling with the hot political and economic issues of today? Well, I was bothered by this too. And I hope that my paper will help to explain that. And while I don't propose to give a capsule version of my paper, I want to make a few remarks. I'm glad that the chairman has permitted me to do this. A historian really is there to provide some background. And in this case, Spain was the outstanding power of all the European powers in America that really grappled with these questions. I think that you will find, if you read the treatises by Las Casas and by many others, that there were very few issues related to native peoples which were not ventilated by one or more scholars. Questions of justice were first raised, of course, by the Spaniards. And I still remember a few years ago when they unveiled a great monument to Antonio de Montesinos, the Dominican, Spanish Dominican, who in 1511 pronounced his famous sermon in the Caribbean against the actions of his own fellow Spaniards. There we were 4 or 5 years ago, this tremendous cement block, 100 feet high maybe, all paid for by the Mexican government. It only had a debt of 40 or billion, or was it $80 billion? But first things first, they paid for this monument. And the president brought over with him a whole plane load full of intellectuales to be there for this great dedication. And since then, many people, regardless of their economic or political positions, have been interested in these questions. I think of myself also somewhat participating in a Spanish bullfight. Those of you who've seen a Spanish bullfight know that there are certain exercises where they tire out the bull, they present things to the bull and he plunges at them, and then eventually the swordsmen come in. And my purpose has been to present the various questions. I don't stand behind every statement in this paper of mine. I do believe that's important to ventilate these questions. I ask them. For example, do the natives seek sovereignty? If so, what do they mean by sovereignty? If they are convinced that they have a special position, what is that special position? And I have even gone so far as to say that, of course, we cannot forget Congress, that it is Congress is subject and always has been to many different pressures, today more than ever. And I've suggested some of the military economic pressures. Likewise, propaganda has never been absent from many of these discussions since the 16th century. And we must remember that Las Casas himself was the greatest source. It was his very brief account of the destruction of the Indies in 1552, which at once was translated from Spanish into English by the English and by the French, by the Germans, by the Dutch. Once when I made a kind of a bibliographical survey of translations of Las Casas for political purposes, there was hardly any issue. In the years since the 16th century, when some power did not bring out another edition of Las Casas to support their position. In 1898, for example, in New York, there was another edition of the Brevissima Relación de la Destrucción de las Indias. In the 16th century, the late 16th century, the Dutch engravers had produced a remarkable series of sketches to illustrate the atrocities which the Spaniards had been committing. Dogs tearing children apart and Spaniards putting to the sword thousands of people. These told a message, and these illustrations were often used. But the 1898 edition had a special twist. They left out all the illustrations, so left blank pages, and said, these sketches, these illustrations tell such a dreadful story, we cannot bring ourselves to put them in this edition. It's another of the propaganda twists, so that Las Casas, although he was the great, in my opinion, a defender of the basic rights of the Indians, he was also used for propaganda purposes. And the struggle goes on. Even Spaniards themselves today are not sure whether he's a glory of Spain or somebody who should be forgotten and opposed. Some of the sharpest arguments against Las Casas have been written by Spaniards. And the Dominican Order has never really done very much for him either. I was surprised in January of this year to find the Dominican Order. In fact, the head honcho himself from Rome went to Berkeley to announce at a two-day meeting on Las Casas lives today, the Master General of the Dominican Order, an Irishman, announced that they were seeking beatification and canonization for Las Casas. This is the first time that the Dominican Order itself has done very much for Las Casas. And Spaniards, as late as 1962, the greatest then living Spanish man of letters, Ramon Menendez Pidal, wrote a book denouncing Las Casas as a paranoid. I remember I was quite surprised and pleased in 1958 when we first met. Don Ramon and I met in Cologne at a celebration in honor of Emperor Charles V. He called me